Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire at occultofpersonality.net. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. A Cult of Personality podcast is available on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher Radio, Acast, and all the best podcast apps. This is episode 170, featuring an interview with author Andrew Philip Smith. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section, and our patrons who participate via the A Cult of Personality Patreon campaign. I'd like to remind you that although you're able to listen to this podcast at no charge, the costs for me to bring it to you are significant. Your financial contributions make sure this free podcast continues. Please support A Cult of Personality podcast by joining the membership section or donating via the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website or via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. Our Patreon page now features an exclusive RSS feed for patrons, meaning that if you subscribe via Patreon to support the show, you will get some content just for you. And if you're already supporting the show or have done so in the past, my heartfelt thanks, and I salute you. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Temple of Thelema is a true outer order of the greater mysteries, providing ceremonial initiation, structure training, and regular group work, all in conformity with the principles of the Book of the Law. An investment of time, effort, and commitment is expected from each member. Each is expected to aspire fervently to the great work, to dare with courage undaunted, to perfect that work, and ever to apply his or her best effort to effect harmony within the order and within the world in general. Founded in service to the AA, College of Thelema seeks to guide the student to an understanding of the Law of Thelema. Most especially, this means a deeper understanding of oneself and of one's true will. A combination of instruction techniques is employed, including seminars, written texts, and individual work. For over 40 years, College of Thelema has published journals in The Continuum and Black Pearl, as well as several books on occult subjects, maintaining high standards in Thelemic education. Visit Temple of Thelema at www.thelema.org. Now, in episode number 170, an interview with author Andrew Philip Smith about his recent books, The Secret History of the Gnostics and Lost Teachings of the Cathars, Their Beliefs and Practices. The Secret History of the Gnostics offers long-awaited illumination on the mystical movement that teaches gnosis, knowledge of God as opposed to unquestioning faith. Acclaimed author Andrew Philip Smith delves into the myths and practices of this ancient movement, exploring its popularity during the 2nd century AD, its subsequent decline under the weight of orthodoxy, in the church, and its present-day resurgence. The secret history of the Gnostics is not simply an authoritative account of one sect's practical beliefs and customs. It is, in effect, a manifesto, an appeal to those inspired by or drawn to the Gnostic faith not to forget its origins. And in the second book, we're going to be discussing Lost Teachings of the Cathars, explores the history of the Christian dualist movement between the 12th and 14th century, offering a sympathetic yet critical examination of its beliefs and practices, as well as investigating the origins of the Cathars, their relationship to the ancient Gnostics of the early centuries AD, and the possibility that they survived the Inquisition in some way. The author also addresses a recent renewed interest in Catharism. Andrew Philip Smith is the editor of The Gnostic and the author of several books on Gnosticism, esotericism, and early Christianity, including the first ever dictionary of Gnosticism. He has also written for New Dawn, Fortean Times, and The Guardian. Originally from Wales, he now lives in Dublin. By my reckoning and many others, Andrew Philip Smith is one of the best modern writers on the subject of Gnosticism, and his books are pure gold if you want to understand this religious philosophy from a historical context. I highly recommend his books to anyone interested in Gnosticism, Catharism, and connecting with these philosophies from an accurate perspective, both spiritually and historically. Andrew Philip Smith, I want to welcome you to the podcast. It's really a pleasure to have this opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for having me, Greg.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Today, we're going to focus on a couple of your books, The Secret History of the Gnostics, Their Scriptures, Beliefs, and Traditions, and also The Lost Teachings of the Cathars, Their Beliefs and Practices, both published by Watkins Publishing. Really excellent books. I highly recommend them to anyone interested in the subject. You will not be disappointed. But before we talk about your books, maybe you could just give those listeners who are not already familiar with you and your work just a little bit of a brief bio and background.
Yeah, sure. Well, my books so far have mainly been on Gnosticism and to a small extent early Christianity as well. So I started off with a very short book on the Gospel of Thomas. It kind of reflected how I got into this. It was through, I have an interest in all sorts of esotericism, and I've become very interested in the magical tradition now. But for about 20 years of my adult life, I was part of a Gurdjieff fish group. And I got into this through the sort of esoteric Christianity side of the Gurdjieff stuff, which was Gurdjieff said a few things about the origins of Christianity and, you know, what Jesus was doing, some of which you might take with a pinch of salt. But then there was this kind of tradition of esoteric interpretation of the Gospels, that particularly Maurice Nicol, who was a pupil of Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and also of C.G. Jung, came up with these interpretations, kind of somewhat allegorical and symbolic interpretations of what was going on in the canonical Gospels. So I kind of got interested in all that. And, you know, I'm talking about 20, 25 years ago now, I started thinking, you know, I wanted to research a little bit more historically. And that turned out to be a whole can of worms. You know, I had the idea that I could just find a couple of books that would tell me what I needed to know. And instead, I ended up, getting very thoroughly involved in following the academic research, all this kind of stuff. And actually, Gnosticism itself, I wasn't all that interested in at the beginning, because a lot of the Nicomedean stuff reads very differently to the canonical gospels. And I'm not even really a Christian either. I'm not a Christian.
Right, so I think that's even more interesting, to be honest with you.
It is in a way, yes. I usually, one thing that people ask me is, are you a Gnostic? I'm getting interviewed, and my standard response is, I don't call myself a Gnostic, but I don't mind people calling me a Gnostic. And certainly in the sense of, Gnosis as kind of direct experiential knowledge. Yes, I'm definitely be happy to be called a Gnostic on that side. But the kind of Gnosticism is the kind of the stuff that you find in the Nicomedean Library, and then in the whole tradition of Gnosticism as it's been labelled. I'm fascinated by it, and I've been on a quest for a couple of decades to understand what's going on there, but it's not quite central, to my spiritual path or whatever. Which kind of gives me—I mean, as we were chatting to each other before you started recording, you were saying how my books are both sympathetic to the subject and kind of critical in terms of the historical content and all that kind of stuff. So that kind of reflects my approach, really, and also have a bit of that kind of class. And as I think a lot of people who do esoteric research these days, particularly the people who I admire, have a kind of clash between the rational and the irrational or the super rational. I'm not interested in esotericism really as a kind of historical hobby or whatever. It is something that I practice in various forms, and it's meaningful for me. But you get this clash between kind of the narratives that are behind the stuff that you're working with, and what you find out historically and through academic study at one move or whatever. So I think it's a good situation to be in, and I don't really see any way around it unless. I quite admire people who go bonkers and just get into it with no questions to some extent. I mean, if they're artists or something like that.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be something I can do.
Yeah, I apologize. I'm getting a little bit of inconsistency from your microphone. So you mentioned Gnosticism as the idea of a direct experiential insight or instance of the divine or deity, maybe. But in your book, The Secret History of the Gnostics, which again, really, really excellent work, your definition is maybe more comprehensive, I guess I would say. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you define Gnosticism, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about the dualism.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Probably, my talking about the, gnosis, you can define as this kind of direct insight. And it probably reflects the fact that I've been listening to an interview with Richard Smoley that I was typing up for a collection of interviews that I'm going to publish. So Gnosticism, it's become a kind of problematic term, actually. And my favorite thing at the moment is saying, I've finally honed down a definition of Gnosticism that I'm happy with, and that's stuff like what the ancient Gnostics used to do. So I start with the ancient Gnostics. So they're these groups that were certainly around in the 2nd to 4th centuries, maybe might have been a little bit earlier as well, and might have stretched out a little bit later. They're Christian-related groups, So, you know, there are a few exceptions with them, but in general, they're definitely connected to Christianity. And we know about them through the church fathers who were writing in the same period, and through the Nag Hammadi library and a few other examples of their scriptures that have survived. And the Nag Hammadi library was discovered in 1945 by a couple of Bedouin brothers in Egypt who were ostensibly out searching for fertilizer, guano, and found these 12 books in jars at the base of a cliff, apparently. And this has actually been brought into question recently. But so up until that point, we had a few examples of Gnostic writings, like the Pistis Sophia, which is kind of fairly late, like 4th century or 5th century even, and eclectic writing, you know, that's pretty well known in esoteric circles and, you know, was read by Madame Blavatsky and became quite popularized for theosophy in the 19th century when this was discovered. And there were some other examples of Gnostic writings that survived. But until 1945, and in fact, you know, a lot of this stuff wasn't translated into English and made available until the mid-1970s. Until that time, scholars were relying on the accounts of the church fathers who were bitterly opposed to the Gnostics and, you know, accidentally preserved aspects of their teachings because they were refuting them and telling people why this wasn't a real version of Christianity. So kinds of ideas in the Gnostic writings, one of the best known is the idea of the demiurge, the idea that the God who created this world is a separate figure from the absolute sort of transcendent God who exists in spirit before anything was created. And the Gnostic writings function in a couple of ways. Another way is through esoteric interpretation, through, you know, the sort of symbolic and allegorical and metaphorical interpretation of scripture, not taking it at its surface meaning, but showing how it refers to the kinds of psychological and cosmological ideas that the Gnostics had. That's kind of the second way that the Gnostics used. But the primary method that they used to disseminate their ideas and to interpret the world was through myth. And these are kind of creative myths, as Joseph Campbell would have termed them. So they're not the kind of myths that grow up organically with a culture or a society or a civilization gradually, you know. These are myths that were perhaps intentionally written down. Perhaps there was a visionary element to them too, that's quite possible. But these myths tend to tell the story that the Bible doesn't tell, and they fill in the gaps in the story of the creation, turn the story of Genesis and the creation and the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve on its head, and reveal what the Gnostics thought was the true story of humanity that lies behind this. Just lies behind the scriptures. And the Gnostics generally identified the demiurge, so this ignorant or malevolent creator of the world, with the God of the Old Testament, with Yahweh or Jehovah. And so you get these odd inversions, such as the demiurge being in the garden, and he's trying to stop Adam and Eve from eating of the tree of knowledge, because knowledge is gnosis. And so the serpent who's leading Adam and Eve to the tree of knowledge is the figure who's trying to show them and give them gnosis so that they understand that the true God is a God of spirit, and that the world of matter has been created by this blind, ignorant, malevolent abortion of a God who is the result of a fall from the spiritual world of the Pleroma. And every time I try to explain the Gnostic myth, I end up wandering around it, and because it is very complex and very inconsistent, but also very creative. You know, there's no two versions of it that are identical. And if you read the Mac Hammadi Library and go through the tractates there, you know, you find time and again there are variations on this story, or it's just the account is different, what's happening is different, the focus is different. But there's always this theme of, something's, the world has gone wrong from the beginning, you know, ever since it was matter. There is a spiritual world and human beings have a spark from the spiritual world, from the Pleroma within them. That should be returned to the Pleroma, and eventually that will probably happen. It will all wind up, and the divine spiritual realm will be restored. But in the meantime, the God of conventional religion, which particularly for them meant Judaism and the emerging Catholic, Orthodox, Christian, stupid, blind demiurge, people who worshipped in the churches and the synagogues and the temples were worshipping the wrong God, but there was a way to worship, well, not necessarily to worship the correct God, but to reconnect with this spiritual world. And teachers had come down through the ages in various forms. Jesus is the most recent revealer in the, to the Gnostics of the 2nd to 4th century. And so there's this ongoing kind of mission to save the sparks of light, the sparks of spirit and divinity, and restore them to the spiritual world. So that's what was going on in the 2nd to 4th centuries, and even maybe a bit earlier. I don't rule out that Gnosticism, may have started almost like, in the Secret History of the Gnostics, I describe it as possibly like a twin of Christianity. And in the Old Testament, you get these stories, I think, like Jacob and Esau, these twins coming out of the womb, and one comes first, and then, he gets grabbed as he's coming out of the womb, and he gets displaced by the other one. So Gnosticism is like the kind of twin of Christianity in a way. And I think it's quite possible that it emerged separately from Christianity, but it became kind of absorbed into Christianity, which became spread very quickly. I can ramble on like this for.
Well, I'll just interject then, I guess. Yeah. No, I'm happy to listen. It's fascinating. One thing that comes up was, so you described this dualism, this sort of good God and the not good God who thinks he's good but really isn't, the creator of the material world or the demiurge, which is obviously, you said, connected with the God of the Hebrew Bible and of the mainstream church, I guess, later on. So I guess, the dualism is inherent there, but one of the things you also mentioned that's what I consider like a really classical characteristic is this inverse exegesis, as you call it, whereby the demiurge is trying to prevent Adam and Eve from their birthright, and the serpent is actually the revealer of the truth. And there's many other examples of this kind of inverse exegesis. Is that right?
That's right, yes. I mean, that's one of those things that got a little bit disputed. But I think it's there. And you find it in these later forms of Gnosticism as well. And you can get things like, like Noah and the flood and the ark. I can't remember which text it is, but in one version, it's actually the demiurge who's trying to preserve Noah and his children on the ark so he can carry on, abusing Christianity and stopping them from...
It's fascinating. Yeah. Do you find that... I guess there's two ways I could ask this question. The proper way that would be, what is it about periods of, whether it's political, religious, social sort of instability that drives people to want to explore these Gnostic beliefs, both in ancient times and I think modern times as well, as you point out in your book. The improper way to ask this question, I guess, would be is Gnosticism like this conspiracy theory of theology?
Well, yeah, I guess there's... all theology is conspiracy theory.
Do you mind if I use that one?
Yes.
You mentioned the dating of the origins of Gnosticism, at least in terms of the sort of Christian Gnosticism. And you also mentioned that there are similar strains of philosophy and practice within other faith traditions, specifically in Judaism, where we encounter the Kabbalah, and seems to have a lot of commonalities. I wouldn't say it's the same by any stretch, but there's so many similar ideas within the Kabbalah and Gnosticism. And I know scholars, date the Kabbalah to much more recent times, like the 10th or 11th century. But earlier, earlier in time, we didn't really have a fixed idea of when these things began or not. And I'm just curious about these similarities, Gnosticism cropping up over and over again throughout time, seemingly disconnected from previous incarnations. And then we see similar ideas in Kabbalah, Neoplatonism, maybe Hermeticism even. And I just wonder if you could comment on how these ideas sort of percolate through different traditions.
Yeah, sure. Some of those are straightforward historical links. Hermeticism, comes from the same period. Also is centered on Alexandria in Egypt. And that really, whether that was the unique birthplace of Christian or Jewish Gnosticism, I don't know. I tend to suspect that kind of different aspects of it popped up in that period in different places in the Hellenistic or Mediterranean Roman world. So the Hermetic writings come from the same kind of milieu as Gnosticism, and we actually find in the Nag Hammadi Library, in I think it's Codex 6, we have the Hermetic text Asclepius, which was one of the few texts that actually got translated into Latin, survived before the Corpus Hermeticum was rediscovered in the West. So we know that these people were reading the same things. Whoever compiled Codex 6 of the Nag Hammadi Library was interested in, you know, Hermetic literature and in Gnostic literature, and obviously thought they belonged together in the same book. The same is true of Neoplatonism. Gnosticism can be seen as a form of Platonism as well. The demiurge, that idea first appears in Plato in the Timaeus. There's also this tradition of, you know, what's called middle Platonism, which includes people like Philo of Alexandria, where Platonic ideas were used to reinterpret the Hebrew Bible in a philosophical way, much of which kind of matches up quite easily with some ideas in Gnosticism. And in fact, Philo was existed in the first century. He was an Alexandrian Jew, a Greek educated Jew. And a lot of the way that he interprets Hebrew scripture allegorically actually matches up with a lot of the kind of stuff that you find in the Gospel of Thomas and in other Hellenistic Jewish literature of the time, this kind of somewhat spiritual interpretation of the stories of the Hebrew Bible. So that kind of fed in, that was another thing that fed into Gnosticism. And in Alexandria, you had this Jewish community that had been there for a long time, spoke Greek, had some Greek education and was involved in the Greek philosophical world to some extent as well. So it was a real melting pot. And also you had the ancient Egyptian or native Egyptian religion feeding into that in ways that are less easy to detect, but are probably still certainly present. So you find Neoplatonism starts with Plotinus, really, and he was in Alexandria, as also were people like Origen, who wasn't a Gnostic but who was Christian, who was also very much into allegorical interpretation, and his stuff was declared heretical later on. Plotinus actually did know Gnostics, there's no doubt about that, because he, in the Enneads, you find a text which is titled Against the Gnostics, and he has a go at Gnostics who were Sethian Gnostics, and he used texts like Zostrianus, which has been preserved in the Nag Hammadi Library. And so he's actually trying to refute them. There are certain aspects of them that he doesn't like. And they, these Gnostics are actually cropping up among the people who are, going to his groups and all that kind of stuff. So, there are definite connections there. And there's a scholar named John Turner who, he actually looking at the evidence and trying to sort of stratify chronologically the, what the texts are telling us about their development and the development of the people who wrote them. He thinks that, like Sethian Gnosticism probably started as an entirely Jewish movement, then sort of recognized that it had some kinship with Christianity. This was a time when Judaism changed considerably with the destruction of the temple and then the exile of the Jews from Judea. Bad things happening in Alexandria as well to Jews. And the religion changing a great deal and becoming the kind of rabbinical Judaism that has survived to this day. At that time, as the religion was changing, it was also rejecting these other forms like Christianity and Gnosticism and probably other, and other kind of heretical or unorthodox forms of Judaism that had been proliferating in the first century. So what he thinks that we see the Gnostics starting with Judaism, probably getting rejected as a form of Judaism and finding some commonality with Christianity and absorbing the Christian imagery and the figure of Christ as a revealer. But then being forced out by the emerging Orthodox Christianity and, you know, looking at the Neoplatonists and thinking, well, actually, we have a certain amount in common with them. You know, we can recognize that Plato is an influence on us too, and, you know, they have this strong mystical aspect to them. And of course, the Neoplatonists at the beginning were pagan. They weren't Christians. There were forms of Christian Neoplatonism later on. But Plotinus was a pagan. Mm-hmm. And so that was probably another cause of his disagreement with these Gnostics who were interacting, you know, with his groups and everything, that they were actually were recognizably Christian still. But you see the kind of Christian influence diminishing in the later Sethian texts. So as for the Kabbalah, yes, you know, I'm no expert on the Kabbalah, so I know, you know, some people believe that in an oral form it might have gone back to that kind of period.
Right. Yeah, first, second century Alexandria, yeah.
Yes, and then, you know, the Merkava mysticism based on the vision of the, you know, the chariot, and which is kind of ascent of the soul, you know, that uses Ezekiel, parts of Ezekiel, this kind of visionary ascent, that was definitely present in that period. And, you know, whether you want to call that a form of Kabbalah or not. And then curiously, I mean, you know, the Kabbalists were chiefly in the south of France, and in Spain, you know, it was really emerging in the medieval period. And so we find them coinciding, living alongside the Cathars. So, you know, whether there was some mutual communication between them there, again, we don't know, but that's a possibility. And then, you know, since I've launched into the Cathars, we can draw another historical thread between the ancient Gnostics and the Cathars via, you know, a bit of survival of Gnosticism into like 6th, 7th century, the influence of Marcionism and Marcion or Marcion is sometimes called, was a kind of, you know, I call him a kind of Gnostic light.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had that kind of dualism. He had the God of the Old Testament pitted against the God of the New Testament, or, you know, the God of the Jews against the God of Jesus. And he, you know, he was a second century figure who was very influential, who, you know, according to the story, kind of got forced out of the emerging Catholic Church. And but he came up with what was probably the first canon of Christian scripture, which was a very cut down affair with just the Gospel of Luke and I think Acts and some of the epistles of Paul. So Marcion, I've never been all that attracted to Marcion. There were some pretty anti-Semitic elements there, and he, you know, he doesn't quite qualify as a Gnostic in my mind, because it kind of lacks that actual element of gnosis and the spiritual element.
Yeah, that sort of transcendent quality.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, Andrew Philip Smith, I want to thank you once again. I really enjoyed both of your books. I find your approach to be really excellent. I don't know how exactly how to describe it, but I can tell you that it's very seldom that I read a historical nonfiction book and get this very attached sort of feeling, like I just want to like curl up with the book and just not put it down. And I don't really know what more I could say to convince people to read your work. But anyway, I appreciate it. So thank you again.
That's great. I always appreciate somebody who reads my work and yeah, is happy to discuss it.
Yeah, I just love your writing style, the way you approach it. Again, the way you're sympathetic to the subject, but not like overly sympathetic, and you're still objective. And the other thing I just want to mention, I'll cut this out of the recording, but the Watkins books, like it's very, I get a lot of paperbacks, and I can tell you that it's very rare that I have paperbacks of this quality, like the paper they use and the printing and just the general way they're put together. They're very nice. So,
definitely. Yeah, and the cover's embossed, I think, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
There's a whole story going on with Watkins, because when the publishing side was revived, it went under very quickly and it got bought out. If you ever been to Watkins Bookshop in London?
No, I haven't.
Oh, well, it's in this alleyway, just off Charing Cross Road, which is just, the other shops are all just secondhand bookshops and antique shops and things. So it's been there over 100 years, and it's one of the oldest established esoteric bookshops in London, probably one of the two, mm-hmm. And then the publishing side, that's been going back decades and decades as well. And so it got sold off, and it was run by another publisher. And then the bookshop went bust, and it's bought out by an American entrepreneur, Ilan Eiffeld, I think, his name. And then so he got the bookshop going again, and then the Watkins imprint was being sold off again, and he bought the imprint. So he's managed to unite the bookshop and the imprint again. And, it's a difficult time for publishing, but he seems to have his head screwed on. And it could easily have gone under and disappeared without trace. Like Quest,
yes,
no longer producing books, mm-hmm. And I did a book with Quest earlier,
Yeah, it's a very difficult time, and I think part of the reason I'm so impressed with these books. I mean, they've just been published, and they're really, really high quality paperback. Like, you just don't see this type of quality anymore. So another reason for bibliophiles to pick up your books, certainly read them, but pick them up anyway. They're beautiful. They're really, really nicely put together. It's really, really quality publication. So sorry to drone on about that, but I get enough books that it made a big impression on me.
That's cool.
Yeah. So again, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. I know we ran over a bit, and I'm sorry again for the technical issues.
That's no problem. It happens almost every time, no matter who I talk to.
Well, I'm glad it's not just me then.
So I'm on Facebook. I'm not very active with my profile, but you can find me, Andrew Philip Smith, two L's in Philip. And also my website is andrewphillipsmith.com, two L's in Philip. I have a little bit more going on the Facebook group for The Gnostic, which is this occasional journal that I've been producing for the last few years, on its sixth issue. And there's also a website to go along with that, the-gnostic.com. And also the publishing house that I have, Bardic Press, BardicPress.com. Where I've published other stuff to do with Gnosticism, early Christianity, Sufi poetry, Gurdjieff-related stuff, a bit of Celtica as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a Facebook page for the Gnostic as well. And then, yeah, I had the two books came out through Watkins last year, Secret History of the Gnostics and Lost Teachings of the Cathars. Issue 6 of The Gnostic came out, and I have another book coming out probably September that we're just finishing the final proofreading on it, which is John the Baptist and the Last Gnostics, which is about the Mandaeans, the people who were arguably the last surviving Gnostic group from antiquity, who've survived in Iran and Iraq, but have, you know, suffered considerably with the chaos in Iraq, and have a diaspora now, and may well go back to John the Baptist. So I've really enjoyed writing that book, and also delving into some of their magical and predictive practices that they've had. And they've a certain, even though they're, you know, a sort of monotheistic form of dualism and Gnostic and kind of Abrahamic, they also absorb aspects of Mesopotamian religion and practice because from living in Iraq. So I trace them back through the centuries. I managed to get the Templars in because some people link them to the Templars, and trace them back through the centuries to their possible origins in the first century as a baptismal group, connections with Nabatea and their peregrinations. So that's coming out. And I also write for New Dawn magazine occasionally. I have an article about the Cathars there this month, and I've written stuff about J.G. Bennett, Robert DeRock, and what might possibly become my next book, an examination of esoteric ideas of epochs and eons and cosmic cycles, and how they might give us different view to the kind of scientific ideas that we have, how the world and humanity has developed through the ages.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Andrew Philip Smith and I continue the interview, discussing Catharism and the continual interest in Gnosticism over the centuries. Don't miss that excellent conversation. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership and sign up if you haven't already. It's the best way to support the podcast while receiving access to a tremendous amount of additional exclusive content. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.